Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo, and being that this is a Friday, we're going to close out this week with some real insightful insights into how, instead of settling for mediocrity, you can settle for excellence. And that is the title of my guest's book. Topher Morrison is my guest. Settle for excellence. Stop chasing perfection. Topher, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Donna. I'm happy to be here.
Well, it's a delight having you. You know, I've got a picture of you in front of me, and apparently you really like mountain climbing, and you have a very interesting background. You have a doctorate in clinical hypnotherapy. You're a certified master practitioner and master trainer of neuro-linguistic programming, which is popularly known as NLP.
Mm-hmm.
And you have traveled all over the world. You have developed what is described as a music trance series.
Mm-hmm.
And you really are a person that likes to reach beyond what might be considered average expectations for many people. You want to do more than that. Tell us your story, Topher. What is it that compelled you to aim for excellence, or settle for excellence rather than mediocrity?
You know, the concept of settling for excellence, like the book title talks about, was that I really think that, first off, I'm a recovering perfectionist. I should probably confess that.
Oh, that's a new one I have not heard. What's a recovering perfectionist?
Somebody who's got to have it perfect all the time, you know, and there's a lot of us out there, too. Let me tell you, I really think, especially in our culture, you know, we've kind of been, you know, in many ways, I think we've been conditioned to seek perfection. We look at the magazines and the TV, and we see these beautiful people, and that creates an image of perfection. But it goes way beyond that. You know, there's people that come up with the idea of the perfect house and the perfect spouse and the perfect car and the perfect job, and if they can't get the perfect one, well, they don't want any of them, kind of a thing. And
mm-hmm.
And I live that life, and I got to say, you know, I can't even say I used to live that way, because I still find myself falling in the trap once in a while, but I'm getting better. And for me, the book was really kind of almost therapeutic in a sense, because I took dang near 10 years to write the thing, and I probably wrote 4 of them. But every time I'd get it done and then I'd reread it, I'd go, well, I don't believe that anymore. Let me change it. It had to be perfect. In fact, I think it was on the second rewrite that the idea of the book, or the third rewrite, actually, the idea of the title, Stop Chasing Perfection and Settle for Excellence, came to mind, because it was like, maybe it's time for me to walk my own talk. And that's kind of where the birth of the title came from, and that's just that's our philosophy now at the office as well. Is we realize that perfection sometimes can just keep people from getting into action, because they're always wanting that perfect time. You know, in fact, I think a lot of people confuse procrastination with perfectionism, and they really don't procrastinate. But what they do is they just don't want to get started until it's the perfect time.
And there is no such thing. There's no such thing in my book as a perfect spouse. There's no such thing as the perfect pet. There's no such thing as the perfect house. Of course, that's just my bias.
No, I agree with you 100%.
I mean, hey, I just say, get a life, folks, because it's not going to happen. And I think when you've been a mother, when you've gone through different things, you go, excuse me, only in commercials where they do the tough chops does it work.
Exactly.
I mean, it's just, and you have to have a good sense of humor. You have started your book out with a statement about you wanted so badly to have your own Yoda, that you were an avid fan of Star Wars. Gee whiz. I think every generation has something. What was it? In the 60s, everybody needed a guru.
Yep.
And then, you know, in the 70s, like in the 80s, it's like, oh, Yoda.
Yeah.
I mean, what did you do? You found a very special person named Martin. Tell us about Martin.
Marcus, yeah, you know, it's so funny. But, you know, before I got on the radio interview, my staff told me, they said, you know, Donna reads the book, and she likes to ask him questions, so she told me, know your book. I got to tell you, man, I've never been more nervous for a radio interview. I feel like I'm ready for a test at school. I'm like, oh, man, I'm sitting there going through the pages in my book going, I hope I can answer the question. Marcus Bach, yes, he was my personal Yoda. In Settle for Excellence, we talk about basically what happened was, I think everybody wants somebody to turn to for advice. You know, we're all looking for that sage, that person who's got the wise wisdom that we respect enough and care enough and admire enough that will actually take their advice. Of course, usually their advice is no more wise than our parents or our best friends or our neighbors, but it seems better when it comes from the personal Yoda, the wise sage, if you will. And I was just blessed at around, I think it was about 20... I was about 23 years old, I guess. Through just a weird chance of serendipity, I ended up meeting the author Marcus Bach, who's written over 29 books on spirituality and religion in his years. And it was just one of those things where I really took to him, and he took to me, and we became good friends. And I always joke around, you've heard the book Tuesdays with Maury. It was kind of like Wednesdays with Marcus. You know, I could get together with him every Wednesday and hang out, and he'd share with me his insights about life and about, you know, what's the meaning of it all, and how do you keep from getting stressed out and stay happy and all that? And you know, a lot of the lessons from the book come directly from Marcus Bach. I wish I could claim the genius of them, but they really come straight from him. It was a lot of his inspiration.
Well, I know he wrote a wonderful book called I, Monty, which was about a butterfly.
And oh, yeah.
It was just such a beautiful book, and supposedly it was for kids, but it was really for kids of all ages. He's a wonderful, wonderful man. You have a quote at the beginning of one of your chapters by Epictetus where you say, men are disturbed not by things that happen, but by their opinion of the things that happen. And I would agree with that
Yeah.
so very, very much. So frequently people will get emotional about things that happen without really seeing what really happened. And to keep your positioning of stability with that, you really have to pay attention. Now, that led you into cause and effect, and your statement is you're responsible for the creation of everything that happens in your universe. That's a very, very powerful statement, and a lot of people are going to say, hey, I want you to know that's not the case. Now, why do you feel that that is a truth?
Yeah, it's a bold claim, that's for sure. I've certainly got a lot of flack for putting it in print, but you know what, here's what I tell people at my programs. They come to me and we talk about cause and effect, and it boils down to this. You know, I think you see a lot of, I mean, I didn't invent the concept of cause and effect. Heck, I guess we give that to Isaac Newton, but a lot of seminar leaders, a lot of authors will spend a great deal of time trying to convince the reader or convince the audience that, in fact, they are the creator of their own universe, and they're at cause, and they're responsible for everything in the world. And you know, my position on it is, and while I believe that to be true, by the way, Donna, my position is this. I don't know that it's true. I don't even care if it's true. I just like the results that it produces in my life. So I'll give you a for instance. You know, whenever we talk about cause and effect, I usually get people that challenge me with terrorism. They say things like, what, are you saying that I'm to blame for terrorism? And my response is, no, you're not to blame. And you are responsible. And I say, let's look at it from two sides of the coin. Let's look at it from the cause side and from the effect side and see which one produces a better effect. So let's look at terrorism right now, Donna, from the attitude of the effect. In other words, I didn't create it, I can't change it, and I'm not responsible for it. On a scale from 0 to 100, how motivated are you to try to end terrorism with the attitude that you didn't change it, you didn't create it, you can't change it, and you're not responsible for it? Give it a number.
Well, I would say my positioning as an individual, just from what your statement is, I have a positioning of responsibility of saying we don't need to be fearful. Let's be educated. Let's look at what we can do, and let's take a proactive positioning with it.
Right. Well, that's going to be more from the cause side. But if you look at it from this whole, I'm not responsible and I can't change it and I didn't create it, mm-hmm. usually your motivation is very low, though. That's the point I'm getting at, right?
Well, I don't know that I would say that it's very low. Maybe in the middle.
Okay, that's fine. Now let's look at it from a different approach. Let's go to the other side of the coin. Let's look at it from the approach, as crazy as this is, terrorism. I created it, I can change it, and I'm sure as heck responsible for it. Now, on that same scale from 0 to 100, where's your motivation? I'm going to guess it's higher than it was before.
Yes, if I took that kind of a positioning.
Sure. And that's my point. Even if it's 1 point higher than the first way, it puts you in a better space to make change. So I don't know that, you know, I don't know that we are the creator of our universe. I don't know that we are at cause for everything in our lives. But boy, it sure does put me in a better place to make changes. It sure puts me in a better place to be more resourceful and to make better decisions and to take better actions. And when you get right down to it, I guess that's what it all boils down to, right? Is that, you know, are you going to take action for the thoughts that you have in your life?
Now, that's a statement that I think is a very significant one, because the mind is a powerful, powerful instrument. You can become extremely agitated, extremely angry, extremely upset and not think.
Right.
And you can go the other way and you can say, wait a minute, what are the facts? Where am I going to go with this? How am I going to respond to it? What can I effectively do to perhaps contribute to a solution?
Yeah.
And it makes a big difference. And I would say many times people are not taught to do that. This is not something that is typically taught in school. Very few families that I'm aware of are going to teach that kind of thinking, because the parents have not had that kind of thinking encouraged. So it really is, there is the cause and effect factoring. And when someone can produce something that is going to create a change in thought somewhere along the line, then you can get some results, good, bad, or indifferent.
Yeah, I agree. In fact, you know, to even add to what you were saying, not only are they not taught, but I think our culture in many respects encourages people to be at the effect. They almost reward people for staying on the effect side of the equation instead of being a cause. But, man, you know, if you were to think of the top five people in life and history that you admire, I promise you this, one commonality, there'd probably be quite a few, but one of them is those people took responsibility for their thoughts and their actions.
Very true.
Yeah.
Very true. And I think that that is a positioning that too frequently people are not encouraged to take. It's, gee whiz, you had this or that or the other happen to you, you poor thing. And that's somewhere along the line. You know, certain things when you're a kid can happen, but when you reach the point of adulthood, you have already the power to engage actively in your life with purpose. And that's the key. It's where do you put your mind. Now, I want you to talk about J.B.
Now, so I was just thinking of him. I was just thinking about a story going, you know, we should talk about J.B. here.
Oh, he is wonderful. He is just a wonderful story. Won't you share that with my audience?
Yeah, I'm not sure what chapter it is in Settle for Excellence, but in the book I talk about one of my experiences when I had a small personal development franchise up in Seattle, Washington, and you know, I had my list of contacts to call, and I got a hold of this guy. In the book I just call him JB, and went to his house. When I pulled up to his house, it was like this immaculate house, huge mansion type thing, and I was thinking, man, I got a sale for sure on this one, you know, and opened the door, and come to find this guy was a full-blown quadriplegic. Had to get around by using a little joystick on his chin to move his wheelchair around. And, you know, the seminar I was selling him at the time was a pretty active seminar where you're, you know, breaking boards and jumping off of things. And I was like, how the heck is he going to do all this stuff, you know? But, you know, I still wanted the sale, obviously. And I thought, you know, we've got some great intellectual things that he can certainly participate in. And so we talked for hours. And this guy, you know, for him, it was never an issue about money. It was never an issue about time, which are the two biggest excuses that most people in life use for never doing anything anyway. He didn't have those excuses, you know. He basically what had happened was he became a quadriplegic because in high school he was sliding into home base. His head snapped when he was sliding in, and it broke his neck. So, you know, he had a huge settlement from the school, obviously, and he was taken care of financially for the rest of his life and didn't have a job, so he had all the time in the world to go to the program. He didn't go. And the reason he didn't go is that he just didn't feel worthy of change. Like, he was so at the effect of his injury that every day he would ask himself questions like, why did this have to happen to me? And, you know, those kind of questions, they don't get you anywhere. And basically, he was just in the same place he'd always been, in a state of real apathy and sadness and depression, and didn't think he was capable of doing anything. And, you know, I couldn't make the sale. I just couldn't get him. But, you know, I felt for the guy, you know. But I also, you know, I wasn't going to let him get away with it either, you know. So I told him, I said, look, you know what, here, take the tape set. Take them home, you know, listen to these. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, I even made a deal with his nurse to play the tapes whether he said he wanted them or not, because I knew he couldn't push the stop button, so he'd have to listen to them. And she was all for it, you know. She was like, you need to go, you need to go. So, you know, we made this little deal. She put the play, she pressed play, and he had basically was kind of forced to listen to these self-improvement CDs. Well, fast forward 3 months later, the guy's in a completely different place, and he stopped asking questions like, why did this happen to me? And he started asking questions like, what can I do with this, and how can I enjoy my life? And the man made a complete and utter turnaround in the quality of his life. You know, he ended up starting a company where he builds vans for quadriplegics. He ended up marrying his nurse. I mean, his life has just completely changed, and it really had nothing to do with the tapes per se, other than it got him to a place of getting to cause and saying, you know what, how I got here is irrelevant. Where I want to go is much more important. And I think if most people in life would stop asking, how did I get myself in this mess, and start asking themselves, what can I do with it now that I'm here, man, they're going to produce a lot better results.
That they will. And it, again, he had to take a position of responsibility.
Yep.
And if he had not been really willing, it never would have happened. But there were those, it was time. He was actually very receptive. You were in the right place at the right time. And he had someone that just understood that this was going to be good for him. So this was, that's a wonderful, wonderful story. Now, I had to laugh at your title on Chapter 5, which is Karma Sucks. I thought that that was a hoot. So I said, okay, what's this guy going to talk about? Now, you've got to tell a little bit about your story.
All right.
About why you came up with that, because you have a stubborn streak in you, my friend.
Oh, man, are you kidding? That's the Capricorn in me. And I'm not even a Capricorn, apparently. I just found out a couple years ago I'm actually an Aquarian, but I thought all my life I was Capricorn, so I always still think I'm stubborn like a Capricorn. But, yeah, Karma Sucks is basically it's an excerpt, actually, out of my journals. And what had happened was I was down in Indonesia. I was climbing one of the mountains down there. And I'm going to make a really long story short. They're just going to, you know, your listeners are going to have to get the book to get the whole story.
Absolutely.
It's just that good. But the whole story was revolved around, you know, I went to this little homestay. I dropped off my backpack. The guy wanted to charge me like 100 rupiah. And, you know, I walked around, and then I found out that he was ripping me off and that I could stay at this other place in a much better location for like 20 rupiah. So I go back. 40 minutes later, I grab my backpack, and he wants me to grab, wants me to pay him. I'm like, man, I'm not going to pay you the 100 rupiah. Now, let me put this in perspective, by the way. 100 rupiah was probably like, I don't know, a dollar. But I kind of lost sight of the game. I was like, I'm not going to pay you your 100 rupiah. You're ripping me off. And I just walked off, you know. Well, that night, I got robbed, and I lost like 1 million rupiah. And so that's where the whole karma sucked, because in the Indonesian culture, they believe in karma. And I called the police, and the police came by, and they were sitting in the room, and I'm all heated. I'm mad that this people that I'm staying with stole 1 million rupiah from me. And the police, instead of, like, feeling sorry for me, which I wanted at the time, of course, you know, they held me responsible. It was such a great experience for me to have to walk my talk, you know. And they looked at me, and they said, in our culture, we believe that you create your universe. So if you've had 1 million rupiah stolen from you, what did you do to deserve this? And I was just so ticked off at him. And then I had to sit there and go, what if they're right? And that was such an eye-opener for me, because then I thought back to this poor guy that I didn't pay the 100 rupiah for. And I realized that, you know what? Even though 100 rupiah is nothing to me, to him, it's worth quite a bit. Maybe, I don't know, what 1 million rupiah would be worth to me.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just such an eye-opener for me, and it's got a great story and a lot of drama, and it's all about, you know what, the whole thing really is about being able to interpret the value of money, because money is nothing but energy, and it doesn't work on a dollar-by-dollar basis. You know, the same level of energy that it takes to make $1,000 is the same level of energy that it takes to make $100,000. And when people get that, that's when they really start to make significant strides in their personal income.
You talk about Marcus Bach and also a man by the name of Thomas.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you said that there were some points that were very significant to you. The difference between Thomas and Marcus, and you'll need to tell us the story behind this, two simple words. And versus or.
Yeah.
Tell us the story behind Thomas and Marcus.
Life-changing experience. Had this guy, Thomas, comes to my office. Now picture this, 35 years old, nice shiny Rolex, probably a $2,000 to $5,000 suit on. You know, wearing the $2,000 Ferragamo shoes, driving the canary yellow Porsche, has a beautiful home down in Newport Beach, engaged to a gorgeous woman who seems to be as beautiful on the inside as she is on the outside. I mean, he's got the package. Good looks, he's got it all, in my opinion. He comes to see me for depression. In fact, 2 years prior to him coming to see me, he'd went to a psychiatrist, was diagnosed with chronic anxiety disorder, given low levels of Prozac to help him with his terrible life and dealing and coping with the traumas of having a wealthy lifestyle, you know. And, you know, I mean, this guy was so off the charts, he even started sharing his plight with his other wealthy friends, discovered they were on antidepressants as well, but they were on stronger antidepressants, so he felt like a loser for being a depressed person. So he convinced his physician over 2 years to up his dosage so that he could have at least some pride in being the best at being depressed amongst his friends. You know, I mean, this guy was off the charts, out of control. And in reality, I kind of just wanted to slap him when he came to the office, but I opted against that and stayed in the professional role and just started talking to him. And, you know, when I asked him, I said, well, Thomas, what's going to take for you to be happy? And he said, his answers were crazy. There were things like, you know, he said, well, here I make $250,000 a year, but there's a guy in my office who makes $400,000. So every time I get my check, it's a reminder that I'm number two. Sure, I've got a nice car, but I wanted the Ferrari. Yeah, I've got a house in Newport Beach, but I don't have the panoramic view that my little brother does. And, you know, we can laugh at it. It's okay. We can laugh at these things. But for him, they were very serious, you know? And mm-hmm. and he was hurting, you know? And then I counter that to my personal Yoda, Marcus Bach. I remember this the same day that I was working with Thomas, I went over to Marcus's house, and it's probably not nice to say, but we were laughing at Thomas's plight, you know. We're just like, mm-hmm. come on, give me a break. This guy's depressed. And, I mean, he was making more money at the time than I was. I was like, man, I wish I had your problems. And so I sat down and I asked Marcus. I said, well, Marcus, let me ask you a question. I said, what has to happen for you to be happy? And his answers sounded like they came right out of a Hallmark greeting card. They were things like, if I can hold my wife Lorraine's hand, I'm happy. Or if I can see a butterfly drying its wings in the sun, I'm happy. You know, he had an affinity to butterflies, obviously, from the book I, Monty.
Mm-hmm.
He said, if I can stay up late enough to see the sunset, oh, I'm happy. You know, these things were so easy to accomplish. And yet, Thomas's were so hard and so rigid. And I noticed that Thomas connected every one of his standards for happiness with the word and. So I've got to make over $400,000, and I have to have a bigger home than my little brother, and I have to make have a Ferrari, and I have to be as physically fit as my girlfriend, and I have to do this. And he set it up to where even if just one of those things didn't happen, his life was miserable. But Marcus, he set his up differently. He changed the rules. He said, if I can hold Lorraine's hand, or if I can see a sunset, or if I can see a butterfly drying its wings. Marcus didn't have to have all of those things happen. He just had to have one of those things happen. So what I concluded from that were two main lessons in my life. Number one is connect my criteria with or versus and lower my standards. Because Thomas's standards for happiness were incredibly high. Marcus's standards for happiness were incredibly low. And that's what the book Settle for Excellence is all about. It's about how to help you take your standards and change them into such a way where you can find out that this ever-elusive thing called happiness, the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, is as simple as you being comfortable with you.
Very well stated. You have a quote in here from Marcus Bach, and for those of you that have tuned in, my guest today is Topher Morrison. Settle for excellence, stop chasing perfection. That doesn't mean you don't go for the best. It means be aware that you don't have to just live for the perfection. Actually, what we've just been talking about is living in a moment, taking
yeah.
what you have in that moment, whether it's seeing a child smile or watching light play in the forest as you're walking through it on the various boughs of the trees and
mm-hmm.
creating your own patterns, whatever it might be. Marcus made a statement, success or failure very often arrives on wings that seem mysterious to us. I think that is such a bit of wisdom. It's so true. I know we don't have very much time left, but I wanted to be sure that people get your website. And then I would like for you to comment on the three rules of nature. I would like for you to discuss those for just a minute or two. But you can find out more about Topher Morrison, not only get his book, but settleforexcellence.com is his website. And you can find out a lot more about many, many things that he does. Talk about the three rules of nature.
You bet. The three rules of nature, I think you're probably talking about the rules of the human psyche, the rules of nature with regard to energy. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, so, you know, one of the things that people absolutely must have in life, if they're going to succeed in any area of life, whether it be relationships or health or work or whatever, is they got to have energy. And so these are the three laws of the human psyche, the three natural laws of human nature that allow you to have or create greater levels of energy. Here they are. Number one, we are as typically, and these are generalizations, by the way, but I'm sure you'll be able to relate as most people can. I know I can. We're typically, as human beings, we tend to be all or nothing creatures. We want it all or we don't want it all, especially when we're not being conscious of our thought process. So, you know, you can see this from the person who says, I'm not going to take a minimum wage job, that's beneath me, and yet they'll take unemployment because, mm-hmm. they, you know, that's not mm-hmm. at all. They want to start off making 100 grand a year. They don't want to work their way up. You see it in relationships where people say, if I can't have you, no one will, and then they do a heinous act of crime, like kill the person they love or something like that. So you can see patterns of this in dramatic examples, but we can also see it in just everyday life. I'll give you a couple of them here in a second. Now, that one doesn't do much in and of itself, but you combine it with the other two, and it determines whether or not you're going to have energy or no energy. Second natural law of the human psyche, incompletions drain energy from our body, both physically and emotionally. When something is incomplete in our life, it sucks the very life force nature right out of us. My favorite example of this would be the house. Donna, I'm assuming you like a nice clean home. Most people do. We'll call a clean home a complete home for sake of argument. Obviously, it needs a little bit more than just a cleanliness. It probably needs a family in there. But we'll just for the sake of argument, we'll just say it's complete when it's clean. You ever have this happen? I know I do. You ever have a nice, clean, complete home turn into like Tornado Alley in 3 days' time?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, you need are a couple of kids, two dogs, and that's the end of it.
Well, if you got kids, 3 days, heck, 3 days, 3 hours, right?
Try 15 minutes.
Yeah, there you go.
On a rainy day. Oh,
Here's how it usually starts, though. I don't know if this is for you in your house, but this is how it happens in mine. It always starts in the kitchen. You know, I might have a nice meal, and I'm a little tired. I had a hard day at work. I don't feel like doing the dishes, so I say I'll clean them later. And then I stick them in the dishwasher or stick them in the sink. Well, later comes. Maybe I have my little late-night snack, bowl of cereal or bowl of ice cream. I don't know what it is. All I got's one little bowl to wash, though. It's not a big deal. I walk into the kitchen. I look at the dishes in the sink. Bam, my energy gets sapped right out of me, and I don't have the energy to clean those dishes now. But I got the time to clean the one that I got in my hand, but I don't. Why? Because I'm an all-or-nothing creature just like you and everybody else. So I say, well, to heck with it. I'll just clean it tomorrow. So I set it on the countertop. Tomorrow comes. I get up. I have my bowl of Wheaties or whatever, my fried eggs. I got a plate. I got a skillet. Not a big deal, but I've got all those dishes in the sink. I don't have the energy to clean them because I'm looking at that incompletion. So I set the skillet on the countertop. I say, I'll get to it after work. Then maybe, I have a great day at work. Feeling good. Come home from the office. I walk into the house. I see the dirty kitchen. My energy, bam, gets zapped again. Now I don't even have the energy to cook. Do-do-do-do-do-do-do. Hello, Domino's. I'd like an extra large pepperoni pizza, please. Now I don't even have a dish. I just have a box. Does this sound familiar, by the way?
Oh, yes, but we better get into natural law number three because we're almost out of time.
Great. Natural law number three, completions give you energy. So the more you complete things, the more energy you have. So what happens is, if you understand these three laws, you can set aside that human tendency to be an all-or-nothing creature and say, you know what, it's okay. I get that I instinctively want to do it all right now, but I'll be happy doing a little bit. And as soon as you do a little bit, that's closer to your completion. Like you complete half of it, gives you half the energy you need. And it's like this, you know, it's like when you start cleaning your house, usually you don't have the time or the energy to do the whole thing, but you get on a roll. And the more you clean, the more energy you get. And pretty soon, you know, you're cleaning up all the knickknacks and everything else. And that happens in career and relationships and health and everything else.
That is so true. And we are out of time. I do want to thank you, Topher, for being my guest. This has been a very dynamic, informative half hour. I want my audience also to know that your website is settleforexcellence.com.
All words, no numbers there, by the way.
Settle for excellence.
Yeah, and you know what? We got more than just the book there. We got freebies for them, too. They can get on there and get free downloads and free books. And we got a whole bunch of gifts for them. We got the notes about everything you and I have talked about today. It's all there. So if they've been driving down the road, wanted to write something down, we got it all for them.
Fabulous. So for much continued success to you. Thank you so much for being my guest today.
God bless you, Donna. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. This is Donna Sebo, and we are getting ready to take a break. Now, don't you go away.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272. Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Ged Rose. Buy it today. 800-872-8852.
As a counselor, Donna Sebo is available for private consultations by appointment. These can be done by telephone or in person. If you'd like to schedule an appointment with Donna, call 253-582-5604 or 800-872-8852. That's 253-582-5604 or outside of Pierce County, 800-872-8852.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Hey, telephone lines are now open. Here are the toll-free numbers to call in to 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. For Canadians, it's 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Also, we have a direct line for everyone else, 530-876-3222. That's 530-876-3222. I just can't tell you how excited I am. Tomorrow and Sunday, it's the second week of the Washington Renaissance Fantasy Fair. This is an event that is just so dynamic, so absolutely wonderful, that I just am so delighted when I see families, entire families come out. Mom, dad, the kids, the dog, the grandparents, the aunts, the uncles. They all come out because it has become one of their favorite events to attend. So if you're in the state of Washington, please come out and say hello. It's going to be from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. in the evening at the Mentor Creek Ranch at 10215 State Road 302 in Gig Harbor. And, of course, those of us that participate, and this is the most wonderful group of people. I've known them for 6 years. We've interacted together, and it's one of the few events of its type that I attend and participate in actively. It's just absolutely a joy. We're all in costume, and all of us have our different characters to play. One is what I call Muddy Mary. And, of course, that's not her real name, but she actually makes a costume of rags because she portrays a beggar woman, and she smears herself with mud. I'll never forget one year we had a rain, and she said, "This is miserable. All my mud is washed off. I have to go out and get some more." She may have one of the easiest costumes to put together. But I'll tell you, it's really fascinating. There's all kinds of character portrayals that are out there, and you'll have a wonderful, wonderful time. So go to their website. If you're in the state of Washington, you get special discounts. So go to WashingtonRenaissanceFantasyFair.com, and you will find all of the information regarding the special package deals, everything and anything that you could possibly know, want to know, and even directions on how to get there. So look for me. Look for my booth. I have large golden banners with gigantic red lions right there. That is my logo when I'm at the Renaissance, and just look for it, and you'll find me there in costume. Come by and say hello. I'd love to meet you. And again, for those of you that are listening, if you're a new listener, I'm so delighted you've decided to join the BBS Radio listening family. You can call in and chat with me, and I'd be delighted to light up your life with some intuitive insight at 877-876-5227 or 888-815-9756 if you're from Canada, and 530-876-3222. I have been asked by people, Donna, you close your show with, you are the master of your fate, you are the captain of your soul. Where did you get that? I've been asked that question. Well, it's a poem by Henley, and this is how it reads. Out of the night that covers me, black as the pit from pole to pole, I thank whatever gods may be for my unconquerable soul. In the fell clutch of circumstance, I have not winced or cried aloud. Under the bludgeonings of chance, my head is bloody but unbowed. Beyond this place of wrath and tears looms but the horror of the shade, and yet the menace of the years finds and shall find me unafraid. It matters not how straight the gate, how charged with punishments the scroll. I am the master of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. That poem to me was so significant. When I started my daily broadcasts over 6 years ago, I decided that that was something that I wanted to, those last two lines, to incorporate into my programming. Why? Because just as Topher was expressing to you, we must be responsible for our lives. And as individuals, we can all be affected by various circumstances. But it's up to us to make the choices and decisions about those conditions and circumstances to determine where we want our lives to go. And I think it's a real sad statement when you meet someone, perhaps you've not seen them for a number of years. I think of someone that I met that I hadn't seen, oh my goodness, it had to have been at least 30 years. And when I sat down with this person, one of the first things that they said to me is they wished they could go back to 30 years before. And the more I listened to their conversation, the more agitated I became, because this individual had not made choices about living in the now. They were not happy with their life, so they would mentally flip their mind pages back into the past and live in that segment of the mind without appreciating or respecting that where they were partially was in part because they couldn't let go of the past. Sometimes we have to let go what does not work. And the past often is glamorized in unbelievable ways. You know, being at this Renaissance Fantasy Fair, as I've mentioned earlier, I just love doing it. But I can remember talking with some people that said, oh, I'd give anything to go back and live in the Renaissance again. And I looked at them and I said, you're nuts. I like my washing machine, thank you very much. The idea of walking in dirt and cow dung and all kinds of stuff, dealing with disease, being in a lifestyle where a woman would be lucky if she lived past 25 years of age, and a man past the age of 30, where most people didn't even have enough food to live. The most of them were starving. You didn't have any of the modern conveniences, and you didn't have soap and water. You didn't have a lot of things. And they looked at me as if I was weird. I said, you're in love with the portrayed romance. Granted, I love to dress up in costumes as much as anybody else. The prettier, the better. However, the reality is, if you really look at what went on in the supposed good old days, you're going to find it wasn't so much a joy and a pleasure. People were literally worked to death. So we all have our perspectives. And when we think of certain things, it could be that there were some things in the past that maybe were very positive and very beneficial. But we have to realize that every segment of history, every segment of life, has its pluses and its minuses. And who knows, the generations forthcoming may be so superior to us in medicine and technology and in so many other things that they'll look back on our days and saying, whoa, those people living in a crude environment. It's all a matter of perspective, isn't it? Depends on where you are. So it's what you do with your mind. It is where you're going to put it. And I really like what Topher said about Marcus Bach. And I had the privilege of hearing Marcus Bach speak a few years back. And this was a very gracious man, very kind man. And apparently in his latter years, he became quite ill. He had quite a few health problems. And it wasn't because this man was not thinking properly or wasn't eating all of his carrots. It was just a deterioration of a body. The body was no longer functioning at peak capacity. And so he made some choices. But this is a man that lived his life with purpose. And Marcus Bach was a man that influenced the life of many, many people in a very positive way. Very kind, very good man. And so I think Topher was very fortunate in having the opportunity to know him. Now, if you'd like for me to light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, if you've never done it before, all you need to do is give me your first name or your initial, and then after that, let me do my thing, and you then can ask a question when I'm finished. Here are the telephone numbers to call in to. 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. Also, 530-876-3222. So many times we have situations around us. If you're in business, maybe you have challenges within your company, and you don't know really who to turn to get an answer from. Well, it took me a lot of years to learn how to ask a question. I can remember when I was growing up, I was to be seen, never heard, and to ask questions was just considered absolutely appalling. It just wasn't done. Well, thank heavens there's been some changes in my attitude regarding that. But so often we look for experts of some kind to help us. But what makes an expert? Who would qualify for that six-letter word of expert? Well, there was a museum that really wanted to know more about visitors, the exhibits it had. They wanted to understand what was going to be more popular with the public. Now, what they did is exactly what most businesses would consider doing. They were going to get consultants, and they were going to have them bid on the job of finding out what they needed to know. They had everything itemized out that they wanted to find out about. Well, there was a senior manager who was talking about this very condition with some other managers, and he said, let me ask you a question. Have you ever talked to people on staff? And I know we've got a caller, but I'm going to ask that caller to wait for a moment until I finish the story. And the people said, no, we've never talked to anybody on staff. He said, all right. He said, let's do something. Let's talk to the people that work here. Now, the bid was going to be a big one. The team of other managers were willing to look for internal insights, and eventually one was found. And do you know who that person was? That was the janitor. Why? The janitor knew where the visitors spent most of the time because he had to mop those areas most often. They were the dirtiest areas in the museum. Visitors voted for exhibits with their feet, and he saw the votes firsthand. Observation. Amazing stuff. This is Donna Sebo. Let's go to our first caller today. Welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling from? Hello, caller. I hear something, but I guess...
Hi. I don't know if I'm listening to you or listening to the show. My first two initials, are you asking?
Just your first initial is all I need, dear, and then I want to know where you're calling from.
Okay, my first initial is A, and I'm calling from California. Do you need the city?
I'd love to know the city.
Palo Alto.
Palo Alto. Okay, I'm going to ask you to have a little more patience with me, if you will,
sure,
because we need to take a break, and when we come back, I'll go directly to you.
Oh, well, thank you.
You're very welcome. We're going to be going right back to A in Palo Alto, California. And if you'd like to call in, here are the numbers, 877-876-5227 or Canadians, 888-815-9756 or 530-876-3222. Now, don't go away. And A, I'll be right with you as soon as we're finished.
Enter the magical world of God's kiss.
He sees a large open area of valley ground covered with a thick green grass. In the open space are many other children and animals. All kinds of animals. And all of the animals are talking. He can understand every word they are saying.
God's Kiss is a beautifully illustrated children's book about a young boy's journey into a valley with children and animals from all over the world. They are gathering together to experience the wonder of love and beauty that will affect their lives forever. A talking book audio narrated by the author Donna Sebo accompanies this wonderful storybook, creating a special magic all of its own. This book package makes a wonderful gift for those special children in your life, ages 3 to 10. God's Kiss, book and talking book audio are only $19.95 plus shipping and handling. And the author, Donna Sebo, will autograph and personalize your book if you request it. Call 800-872-8852. You can also order through Donna Sebo's website, www.delphiinternational.com.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo, and we're going to go directly to A in Palo Alto, California. A, are you still with me?
I sure am, thank you.
You're very welcome. Let's get down to business with you. First thing I am looking at is the word joy. And as I'm observing you, it is as if you are putting something behind you that you have worked towards releasing from your environment for a long time. Now, at this moment, I cannot tell you if it's emotional, if it is mental or physical, but there is such a sense of joy that permeates my being as I am focusing on you. I would just want to say congratulations. You worked very, very hard to reach this point. Now you seem to be in sort of a standstill mode, and I think the reason you're in the standstill mode is because you really feel as if you need to evaluate carefully where you want to shift yourself into. And I compliment you on that also, because I think that is wisdom. Don't worry too much about the rest of this year. I would say whatever loose ends might be in your environment, just take care of them and take the time to be introspective. Take the time to really be reflective, because if you do that, then as 2008 approaches, you're going to find yourself ready with a strategy for action and decision that I think is just incredible, absolutely incredible. So I want you to be aware you're on track, you're not lost, your life is good, and you are going to find yourself doing some really very satisfying and self-fulfilling activities that you've wanted to do for a long time. And thinking things through is the right way to go. Do you have a question for me?
No, that's great. And that's about right on. That's where I'm at right now. And I'm just getting stuff out there on the Internet as far as recreating my musical career. So. And I have projected my new CD for 2008 for the end of the year, beginning of next year, and that's perfect. And I'm thinking it through how I want to do it this time.
Very good.
And,
be patient with it. Take the time to do some of what I call the nature walking, just observing what's going on around you. Just listen. Take those moments, if it's early morning walks, evening walks, whatever you like. But do that for yourself, because it allows you to hear. And that may sound a little strange, but it's as if there's something inside of you that you can hear when you do that.
Perfect.
And apparently fall is one of your favorite times of the year.
It is. I love it.
You need
it's always like a new beginning.
Yes. It has its own particular fragrance, its own particular feel, and I'm seeing you walking with a jacket on. And
yep.
You're just moving along, sort of. You're not a high-paced walker, but it's just this observation, this feel that I get. And it's when you're in that feel, clarity is available to you.
Excellent. Perfect.
Well, thank you so much for your call.
Well, thank you for your answers. I appreciate it. I'm looking forward to the rest of the show.
Well, how'd you learn about the show?
I love BBS Radio, and I check everybody. I heard you about 2 weeks ago, and you were sharing with somebody, and it was so right on. I mean, it was a fella, and he really had nothing to say after you told him where he was at, and I thought that was pretty spectacular. But I just wanted to tune in today. I'm doing some work in my studio, and I was listening to you, and I just... Something impelled me to, projected me into calling you.
Well, thank you so much, and do tell your friends about the show.
I sure will.
Thank you so much, A. Have a fabulous day.
Thanks, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. This is Donna Sebo, and if you'd like to give me a call, 877-876-5227, Canadians 888-815-9756, or 530-876-3222. I can do the same thing for you and with you, as I just did for A. And don't forget, tomorrow, the second weekend of the Washington Renaissance Fantasy Fair. Oh, I have to tell you, I've got a brand new costume. Drop-dead gorgeous. I love it. It's wonderful. And the hours for this fabulous event is 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. It's at the Mentor Creek Ranch at 10215 State Road 302 in Gig Harbor, Washington. They've got jousting, equestrian events, dancing, oh, wonderful shows, live chess tournaments, food like you wouldn't believe. There's a crepe cookery there that is to die for if you really enjoy that type of food. Turkey legs, you name it, we've got all kinds of goodies there. They even have lattes, believe it or not. I know that's not Renaissance, but hey, we can only go so far in Renaissance. We've got to have some real, real food from the real life world. But they've got all kinds of wonderful activities for adults, for children, and it is awesome. So I hope to see you out there. Look for my booth. It has gigantic yellow gold posters or banners with huge red lions on them. The red lions are my logo. So I look forward to having a chance to say hello and to perhaps visit with you for a few minutes. I'm there doing some mini readings for people. So come along to the Washington Renaissance Fantasy Fair. Go to their website. You'll get all the information about the prices, directions on how to get there, and everything else. We have people come in from all over the country. We've even had people that have come in from Australia. It's just wonderful to be able to talk to all of these different individuals that come out for this wonderful, wonderful event. Oh, I've got to tell you about the people that are going to be coming up next week. Wow, have we got a lineup. If you're involved with children and you want to know about how children can be taught more effectively, Michael Maloney is a man who has dedicated a great deal of his life to teaching, and this is what he tries to pass along. This is his legacy, how to teach your children well. Judith Bowman is going to be my guest. Judith has been on my program before. She is a protocol consultant, and her brand new book is called Don't Eat the Last Donut. Provocative title, isn't it? Well, she's got a lot of good, stable information in there. And if you're in business or if you have family members that you think, oh, these people need to learn how to behave in public, you're not going to want to miss Judith. She's got some wonderful, wonderful information to share. Robert Bruce is going to be my guest also next week. We're going to be talking about energy work. This book, Energy Work, is a how-to book. And he has dealt with working with energy. He's a scientist. He's a researcher. This man really has taken a great deal of time and effort to teach how you can utilize this. Then, if you are a pet lover, you're going to love my guest next Thursday, Loretta Scott Miller. We're going to be talking about a blind puppy for $5. Oh, just a heart-touching story. And then Wayne Peterson is going to be our guest next Friday. Extraordinary times. Extraordinary beings. This is, well, rather provocative. So you're not going to want to miss any of it. And I hope that you'll join me. This is Donna Sebo. We've run out of time. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. Excellence, make it the word that you tattoo mentally on your forehead. because you are that. You just need to polish it up and let it shine so that others will know that you don't settle for mediocrity. You settle only for excellence. This is Donna Sebo. Talk with you on Monday. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.
Seventeen, I lost my dream. Packed my bags with little things. Two more days, I'm off the plane. The whole world's gone insane. They gave me orders, take this gun. You'll have to shoot this till the day you're done. Fear takes over me, now I'm facing my mortality. Best I can. On this same ground, I'd have to gun him down.
From my patrol,
somewhere I lost my soul. They call me hero, so they say. Even though they buried me today,
it means nothing to me.
Now I'm just another casualty. Best I can. The same after seeing someone giving their life. Yeah, something's gotta change before we all die. Never knowing if this is right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
2,000 soldiers killed in the war, yet no end is in sight. Many say the pretense for WMD was simply a ruse by government officials. Many soldiers must die is the question many parents of these brave young men are beginning to ask.
Soldier in the sun, best I can.
Daddy, listen to me, sir.
Liberty, freedom, here is me.
I'm just a soldier in the sand, trying to do the best I can. Gotta protect the promised land. Please, you gotta understand. Stop the war and poverty. The only freedom here is me. Can't believe the things I see. God, the war is killing me.
Hi, this is Brentwood from Legion of Love. Just letting you know you can now hear some of our new released and unreleased tracks on our website, legionoflove.com. You can also purchase our EPs, Gray Matter Tunes and Matters of the Heart, as well as all of our singles, including Shine a Light and Love is the Answer, at most major download sites. And of course, you can hear them on BBS Radio, the number one internet radio network in the world. Peace and love.
Fishing boats are gone.
Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio, where we talk about the things that really matter. We talk about the state of the world today. We talk about the state of conscience. We talk about how we're all going to get through this. Now, if you want to call in, we do have some call-in lines, and I'm going to tell you about those right now. Those numbers, if you're calling from the United States, are 877-876-5227. Or you can call from Canada to 888-815-9756. Or you can call us direct to 530-876-3222. Now, this show is carried online, but you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. And if you want to find out if one of those old-fashioned on-the-air stations in your area carries this show, you just contact us at bbsradio.com. Now, I also have a blog, and you can access my blog, which is How the Neocons Stole Freedom, at http://howtheneoconsstolefreedom.blogspot.com. And what you're going to find this week when you go and check it out is an article called Tipping Point America. And that's an article that I wrote that's a synthesis of several different things that have been happening that most of us are sort of afraid to know too much about, but they are out there, and so we do have to know. Now, one of those things is the markets, because we can all see exactly where the economy is going. It's going south. If you take a look at the credit market, take a look at the stock market, take a look at mortgages, if you take a look at the currency, everything is pretty much headed toward the tank. As a matter of fact, just today there was an announcement about the Chinese attitude about our currency, and that said very, very much bad things about what would happen if they decided that they were simply going to sell dollars. And that attitude, I think, is reflected over much of the world. You know, Americans have never had less credit and more debt. That's where we are today. That's what's happening. At the same time, and this is one of the things that I talk about in the article, what we're seeing is that Americans are looking at a very different relationship with their police. I don't know if you've noticed it, but most of us have. A relationship with the police, if they pull you over, you're not looking for somebody who is necessarily going to be friendly and helpful and courteous and concerned. You're a little bit afraid you might end up dead. Even what happened was just a traffic ticket. So that's another thing that, you know, we're all taking into account now, today, in America. Now, having said that, there is some good news out there. This weekend is going to be the Republican straw poll in Iowa. And candidate Ron Paul is making great strides in that state, taking his message of freedom and the and real constitutional rights to the people. As a matter of fact, the local paper in Ames, the Ames Tribune, has had a hard time filling the orders for copies of their paper that have an ad for the Ron Paul campaign. Now, it's kind of unusual. People would go out and especially buy a paper simply because there's an advertisement. But in this particular case, that's what's happened. The advertisement is made up of hundreds and hundreds of pictures of Ron Paul supporters, made up into a collage superimposed on the Declaration of Independence that looks like a picture of the congressman. And it's really very exciting and interesting to see something like that paid for by volunteers, because that's one of the things that's starting to really shine out about the Ron Paul campaign. Instead of a centralized campaign where people try to emulate public support and public excitement and grassroots, you have the real article. You have people taking their own time and their own money and their own innovation and going out there and doing the thing, running the campaign, hitting the doorbells in their neighborhood, handing out literature, putting up signs, doing all of those things that, when you put them all together, really spell out the real thing, a real grassroots campaign that when people shake hands with him, when they can hear what he says, they listen, they hear, and they believe. Because they look back on a history for Ron Paul that says exactly that. It says that this is who I am. I'm nobody else. I'm not anything else. And if this is what you want, this is what you get. That's kind of exciting, isn't it? Kind of different and kind of interesting. It sort of gives you a flutter of excitement in your stomach when you walk down the street, imagine in Iowa, and you see people, just ordinary people, standing there holding signs for a candidate, and they're all really different signs in many cases because they've made them themselves at home. Kind of exciting. So that's the piece of good news that I'd like you to think about, because that's a piece of news that I think that we all sort of need to hear, that it is possible to take America and put it back into the hands of the people, because here's a group of people demonstrating exactly that principle, that we can put it in, that they can take it into their own hands, something that we've thought, oh, that had to be handled by a campaign committee. That had to be handled by people who had gone to school and had studied how to do it, and they knew what they were doing. And instead, what you have here is a group of people who, frankly, most of them didn't know anything about it. Most of them have never had anything to do with a campaign before in their entire lives, and they are going out there and making that happen. And if you want to get active in the Ron Paul campaign, there are several different ways of doing it. One of the things that you can do is go online, find your local meetup group, and there are meetup groups in all parts of the country now. In many cases, there are meetup groups that are more than 100 people in a little area, and they get together and they do things. They make it happen. They make it work. And again, that's pretty exciting. Now, let me tell you just a little bit about our guest tonight. Now, his name is John Judge. And when you go to his website, which is judgeforyourself.us, you see something kind of interesting and different and unusual. You see a quote from him. And what that quote says is, "You can call me a conspiracy theorist if I can call you a coincidence theorist. I prefer to say that I'm an alternate historian." John Judge is he's a researcher, he's an activist, he's a public speaker. John Judge has spent a lot of his life focusing on unexplained events, things that we look at and we argue about, and people have even started having conferences and conventions to discuss over and over and over again. He's somebody who's done some very definitive research on things like the JFK assassination, the RFK assassination, the Martin Luther King assassination. He's the co-founder of COPA, coalition of political assassinations. Now, he's the kind of guy who takes these things seriously. So one of the things that he did, of course, you can imagine when 9/11 took place, he was always already very aware of the possibility of that because of what had happened in the early 90s related to the same facility. And what he did is he followed his sort of protocol, because this is a guy that does this. He doesn't pay any attention to these exciting theories that people come up with. It's, do you remember that? It was a TV show, and what the policeman on it said, it was just the facts, ma'am, just the facts. Well, that's what John Judge does. He just wants the facts. So what he's done with the facts in the case of 9/11 is he's compiled them. Facts, not theories. So that what you see, you know, with his bibliography, for instance, is 51 pages of single type with, you know, source after source after source after source that are hard, factually based. And what that's enabled him to do is to debunk many, 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 many of the theories that you see floating around about 9/11. Now, when I talked to him earlier, one of the things he said that I thought was very, very interesting was that he has personally talked to people who write about theories about 9/11, and what they say is that, well, you know, they can make a living doing this. As a matter of fact, they can make a lot of money doing this. And that really should give us pause for thought, shouldn't it? So that's one thing about John Judge. He's the kind of person who actually could have done something like that and chose to do something else. What he chose to do was to give people the facts. Pretty exciting. Now, from 2005 to 2007, he was also Special Projects Assistant to Representative Cynthia McKinney of Georgia. And I'm sure all of you remember Cynthia McKinney. She was the legislator who went to Congress and started asking a lot of the hard questions about what was going on with the war in Iraq, why we were doing something about getting out of there. And that was a very good thing for her to do. Before she left in January of this year, they compiled articles of impeachment, and John was one of the people who helped compile those articles. So there are not too many people who can say that they actually helped compile articles of impeachment against the sitting president. But he's someone who's done that. And another thing that he has done is he is an advocate for active duty soldiers whose desire to declare themselves conscientious objectors in the face of something that any conscientious person would have to object to, namely the war in Iraq, are harassed by this administration. And I think that we've all heard about what happens to people on active duty when they simply decide that this is something that they cannot cooperate with, haven't we? So, that's another thing that he's done. Now, John lives back in Washington, D.C. He was actually introduced to me by a good friend of mine, whose name is Mike Hirsch, who we've had on the show about some other things before. But he's somebody that you're going to want to hear from and to talk to, and so that you can understand his, I think, very unique viewpoint. And you can see where that takes him, and I think even more importantly, where it can take us. Because where that takes us is to a point of understanding that creates a unification of opinion, because we have the facts. And those are the hard ground that we all need to stand on so that we can move forward. And that's really what you need to know about this guy. He goes after the facts and he gets them. Now, when we started the show, he had not yet arrived at his cell phone. So I'm hoping now that our engineer has managed to find him. So, it's my very great a privilege to introduce John Judge, if he's there. John, are you there?
I am.
You know, I cannot tell you how happy I am to hear you.
Yeah, well, I've been in since about 7 o'clock.
Okay.
He patched me through, so I've just been listening.
Well, I'm glad, and I hope you like the introduction.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's good. So why don't we get started? I think I've told people exactly what we're going to get into tonight. And I know that they're going to be fascinated because everybody I've told about you and about this show has said, oh, my God, I don't want to miss that one. So I'm glad you're there.
Okay.
I'm glad I'm here. Let's get started.
I think another major area that I've been working on recently is a real democracy project that has to do with solutions and democratic solutions, transparent solutions, and alternatives as a way out of the problem. So I'm not just digging into what's wrong, but I'm trying to figure out what could we do to envision our own liberation in our generation, which is essentially what the founding fathers did, but even Jefferson realized that their vision of liberty and freedom would not necessarily be that of their children's,
mm-hmm.
and that there would have to be continual revolutionary changes in society, and that there would have to be new visions. And he said that even if he liked a threadbare coat and it was his favorite to wear, he wouldn't force his children to wear it, or even force them to eat the fruit of a tree he had planted to their benefit if they didn't like the fruit. And, I think that he understood that every generation needs to reinvent what it considers democracy and freedom. And unfortunately, I think we haven't done that between the 17th and the 21st century. And we've got a lot more tools to make real democracy happen now and to decentralize and to make it participatory. But we also have a long standing structure that's obsolete in my view, and calls itself representative democracy when it's not, and that actually gets in the way of real democratic processes. So among the projects I have under real democracy is the idea of establishing a hidden history museum in D.C. That would tell some of the history that's not told in the official museums or in the textbooks, and to bring forward the best new material that's being unearthed, but to have something there that we have 6 million people a year that come here to visit, whole families, and to have something that both young people and adults could come and see that would tell them something about the history that's basically been stolen from them since 1947,
mm-hmm.
and the establishment of the national security state and the massive secrecy. Near me in D.C. is Suitland, Maryland. And the military records of the National Archives are there, only the military records, and primarily the records since the end of World War II. And they are in underground buildings in Suitland, and each building is an acre in size, and there are 27 buildings. Sorry?
That's mind-boggling, an acre.
An acre in size, and there are 27 buildings, 27 acres of buried military history just since the end of World War II.
You know, somehow I don't think we should have that much military history. I think if we were doing it right, there wouldn't ever be that much military
right,
history.
One would wish there weren't. John Dean recently said that if President Clinton's executive order had been implemented when Bush came in, after Clinton went out, which was to have an agency review of all documents 25 years or older to see if they were ready to be released, had that even been implemented, that as many as a billion records could have been released under that executive order. And yet every year over 15 million records are classified,
mm-hmm.
and buried anew. I went to a conference here on Sunshine Project where a lot of the newspapers were supporting this recent change, and it's a positive change in the Freedom of Information Act to make it a little stronger and make the agencies comply and patch up some of the holes in the bucket. But I was trying to point out to them that the bucket they're patching up and repairing is trying to drain a spring-fed lake.
Well, yes, you can't do enough. And we have really, if you take a look at how much transparency there is in government, there's none.
Almost none, and very little aggressive oversight being done by the Congress, which is its job. So you have a mentality that of more secrecy. In fact, the Bush administration has been going through the archives and reclassifying previously declassified documents since 9/11, burying things that had already been released, as well as creating matrix systems of lists of people that and documents that they don't want to see the light of day, even if they are classified, and operating in ways that that make congressional oversight impossible. One recent move under an executive order for emergency response has moved all planning out of FEMA and the DOD, which are had bad plans, but at least they're capable of being overseen by Congress, and moved that planning for continuity of government inside the White House under their terrorism branch. And recently, one of the senators attempted to get a copy of the plan and was not only denied but openly rebuked.
I remember that. It was incredible, because how can they make decisions intelligently if they don't have the information?
Exactly. And it reminded me of the Pike Commission hearings in the 70s, where Otis Pike asked to see the document that created the Defense Intelligence Agency.
Okay,
just its legal basis, not its internal workings, and was rebuked, and they said that's national security. And he said, I'm not asking you for, he said, I approve your budget every year, which is actually 85% of the intelligence budget in the United States goes to the military and the DIA, which most people have never even heard of.
What does DIA stand for? Tell
Defense Intelligence Agency. And it includes the National Reconnaissance Organization, which is, I think, now called Geospatial Intelligence Agency. It's the spy satellites. Includes the National Security Agency, which is all the electronic message retrieval and monitoring. It includes Office of Naval Intelligence, the oldest and largest intelligence agency in the United States, as well as other branch intelligences in the military, and the Defense Mapping Agency and other agencies. So the CIA and the FBI are about one-tenth of the personnel of the combined of the Defense Intelligence Agency.
Mm-hmm.
And when the CIA thinks up something to do, it goes to the DIA to actually have it carried out. So Pike just asked them to see their charter on which they were legally based, and he was denied that.
Well, I guess that shows him how important he is.
Yes, and by that light, how less important all of us are in their view.
Yes,
but
well, you know, it's like we're not even ants.
If your history can be stolen, you are a conquered people.
Well, I think that that's absolutely true. When did you become aware of what was really going on? Because
Pretty early on, because I grew up in a family of civilian employees of the Pentagon.
That's interesting.
I grew up in that building. My mother was five levels above top security, the highest paid woman in the Pentagon. I grew up in the bedroom community of the NSA, the CIA, the DIA, and the rest. And,
what a fascinating background. So there must have been so many things that sort of just oozed into your mind.
Uh-huh. Well, I like to read. My mother would drop me off.
Breathed.
My mother would drop me off in the Pentagon Library when I was a child. And, you know, there wasn't classified information there, but there were many things that you couldn't see in a public library,
mm-hmm.
or wouldn't. And then, you know, as I got older, I would go to the Christmas parties and the New Year's Eve parties around the block to the different houses. And, you know, they'd be a little drunk and they'd talk shop. And it became clear to me fairly early on that there were two governments operating. What really got me buried into the work was the war in Vietnam, and starting to try to do research and background on that in 64, 65 when I came out against the war, and studying the French involvement there and how the U.S. took over, first supported the French and then took over from them, and the illegality of that war. And that backed me into the intelligence agencies. And then in 68, I read one of the early critics' books of the Kennedy assassination, and then went into the library and read all 26 volumes of evidence in the case, and talked to early researchers.
You're probably one of the few people who has actually read all of that information then.
Yes.
And
Vincent Bugliosi, who's got yet another book trying to support the official position,
mm-hmm.
Which is disingenuous, he called me in the course of writing the book, and he said, well, you probably don't agree with me, Mr. Judge, but I think Oswald acted alone. And I said, no, Mr. Bugliosi, I think Oswald acted alone. We all do. I said, I just don't think he shot the president. And he laughed and said he hadn't heard that one before. But he has turned it around on the critics And he goes into law schools and asks how many people think that there was a conspiracy in the Kennedy assassination, and the majority of hands go up. And then he says, how many think Oswald acted alone? And very few think so. And then he says, and how many people have read the Warren Commission evidence and volumes? And again, very few hands go up. And he says, well, see, if you read the evidence, you'd agree with me that Oswald acted alone. Well, in fact, it was because some of the evidence was released and some of the early critics went through it and compared it to the report that we know that their conclusions were false, not the other way around.
Let me ask you a question, because you've got an incredible body of knowledge there. You must have come to some conclusions, not about necessarily even what happened in particular cases,
mm-hmm.
but about the dynamics of the organization that you were looking at. So
yeah.
What is, I mean, the CIA, all of these organizations, what do you think that if, let's ignore what they say their mission statement is, what do you think their mission statement is? Why
well, I
did
think
they
the
keep
beginnings
going?
Of intelligence were the U.S. sort of had very little and picked it up from the Brits to the extent that they did have anything. Naval intelligence is the oldest one that came out of their things that they learned from the British Navy. But the real buildup of intelligence was during and then after World War II, and World War II in the end is won as an intelligence war more than a military war. And those intelligence agencies like the OSS and others that sprung up had a lot to do after that with who the rulers would be. I often say the Pentagon, the presidents come and go, but the Pentagon and the CIA sit and grow here in D.C.
They come and go and they grow. That's
yeah.
I love it. That even rhymes.
And, you know, that's the reality is that they control a great deal more of the policy than any particular president. And the presidents are clearly, after 1963, expendable if they get in the way of those agencies. John Kennedy, in October, said that he was going to scatter the CIA to the four winds. And
I guess
that
was the wrong thing for him to say, huh?
You know, they're increasingly, along with the military industrial complex, and Eisenhower's first draft of his talk, when he left office, his original draft warned of a military industrial intelligence complex. And he saw the rise of those two things, and the control that they would have in the society as dangerous. And he's no mean cold warrior himself and a general, but he could see what direction the society was taking. So after 47, I mean, you have these people who came out of the banking firms like Sullivan and Cromwell and others, and Alan Dulles and John J. McCloy and Bill Donovan of the OSS, William Casey. A lot of these people were investment bankers, and it was interest to them where the next shoe would fall.
Mm-hmm.
And then they realized that they didn't have to wait and merely collect intelligence and predict, that they could influence where it would fall and make a profit on it that was doubly insured. You know, it's like betting on a known horse in the race when you've drugged all the rest.
Mm-hmm.
And someone who's rich enough and smart enough will bet on every horse in the race because, you know, they're going to win no matter what happens. And so, you begin to put your hand into a lot of pies. But in the end, it was to protect foreign investments and banking investments, to project, profits through that, and also then to have social control, not only here but abroad, to identify where resources are and make sure that that corporate investment got their hands on them, and cheap labor costs, and markets were opened and retained. And so that really was a lot of it. Of course, there was the rivalry going on for some period between KGB and CIA, but in large part, I think that the military-industrial and intelligence complexes in both those nation-states grew up in relation to each other and sort of buoyed each other. It was more of a symbiosis than a war.
Well,
and
you know, I've always
got privilege and got social control out of the fear that they created in both those societies.
Because you always have the 401k syndrome. I mean, once you're in it and that's your world, you don't want that world to become unnecessary because that destroys your world.
Well, that's right. And in the 80s, what I started to see was that the intelligence agencies, RAND Corporation, the independent study contractors, the War College at the Pentagon, and and the War College, the studies that they were putting out in the 80s acknowledged that they knew the Cold War was going to end, that they could no longer maintain the huge intelligence and military budgets that they had had in the past from the tax dollar. There was even talk, if you remember, of a peace dividend. But they didn't want to go that direction. They wanted to maintain the profits and the warfare and the social control. And so what began to crop up in those years was the new boogeyman of terrorism and the response of counterterrorism. And the counterterrorism response in their early planning in the 80s, and I did a talk in 96 called Are You Scared Yet? Based on this, it was to have scenarios of terrorism going from conventional to chemical, biological to nuclear weapons threats that would lead to establishment of a continuity of government rather than a democratic state that would put people in a state of democratic suspension during an emergency, that would break down posse comitatus and the separation of civilian and military rule, and that would establish martial law and suspension of constitutional procedures.
So you're really saying that you have government, and you have the people who, you know, they definitely want to position themselves and be elected to positions where they can have a relationship with corporations and get money, and those are the people who go into Congress, they go into state legislatures, they go into the executive branch like president, and at the same time, you have the intelligence community that has its own sort of, you know, reason for being and a world
right.
that it's creating by with its ideas that. And those ideas go to the idea that it's going to do whatever it needs to do to maintain the things that keep it prosperous and healthy.
Yes, and
profitable.
And it's not a complete separation between the corporate world and the government world. And there's more and more privatization, you know, and the global foreign policy of the United States is also trailing behind the global corporatization of the planet.
Well, if you talk about privatization, what you're not really talking about privatization. What you're saying is corporatization. Because
nobody
has ever turned anything back to the individual that created it.
Yeah, it's not privatizing it into individual hands, but I'm saying it's taking government function and putting it out for profit.
Yeah, but that's corporatization because they don't ever hand it to an individual. It's only to corporations.
Okay, I understand your point.
Yeah, okay.
But, the point I'm making is just that you get these revolving doors, what they call the Iron Triangle of the military-industrial complex. People become generals and they come back in. I mean, Cheney's a sterling example of somebody in the government policy. Then he's out in the corporate world. Then he's back in the government making policies that influence the corporation that he was sitting in, you know.
Okay. So we sort of see the structure here of what's going on, and each of these components feeds each other.
Yeah. And I think the other thing that's important to understand, though, is that this is not monolithic, that you have segments of the capital and the class and the wealth that have developed that are different from each other and that have different themes. And one of the early JFK assassination books, critical books about that, was Carl Oglesby's Yankee Cowboy War. And while the lines aren't absolutely clearly driven, there is a difference between the old Anglophile central banking and investment of the Eastern establishment and the old rich families who are mostly investors, and then a new entrepreneurial capital that sprung up essentially in the southern rim of aerospace, munitions, making the munitions and for the military industrial complex, oil and land speculation, and created a southern rim economy in the book Powership by Kirkpatrick Sale, some of this is laid out, and it was much more nativist and much more reactionary, and those two were at odds with each other. So you had a lot of Yale Tweed boys at the CIA, but then you had much more sort of southern industrial complex people, you know, running the operations in the DIA. And for a while, the presidential tickets would be split between an Eastern establishment figure like a John Kennedy and a Southern establishment figure like LBJ.
Well, yes, you'd have to notice that because, and so you're saying these were actually representatives of
segments within the rich and the class structure. And those segments fight each other. And as they get closer to these martial law scenarios and total control scenarios, they fight each other harder because whoever comes out on top of that is going to be in charge of a lot of things. And so, to some extent, what I began to see was that scandals like Watergate or Contragate and these other things were only scandals because one side of the class was spilling the beans on the other side.
So they were using that as a means of control. So there's
yes.
definitely tension between them and their positioning.
Right.
And that's
which doesn't mean they weren't guilty. I mean, Nixon did bad things, but on the other hand, it's clear to me that he was framed to push him out.
Oh, really?
Yes. And then you have assassinations, like the Kennedy assassination, that allow an ascendancy of a segment of the class, or the shooting of Reagan, where the well, he didn't actually, none of his bullets hit Reagan, but he's a named patsy in the case. John Hinckley comes from a family. His older brother was scheduled that night to have dinner with Neil Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And
I've heard that.
Yeah, and then it was reported in the Washington Post, but they called it ironic. I said, well, if I told you that one of LBJ's daughters was going to have dinner on November 22nd, 63 with Robert Oswald, Lee's older brother, would you call it ironic, or would you think it meant something? If you don't think it means anything, then you can call me an irony theorist.
Well, was she?
No, but I'm just saying, isn't it enough to know that these guys canceled their dinner and that they were that close? And if you go back, you'll find that the Bush and Hinckley families are cross-invested and quite close to each other.
Well, a lot of these big families, a lot of these families are.
Yes.
They actually share a very common background, and mm-hmm. I think there's some things that are misconstrued about that. They tend to have a common family culture, and the family culture actually is that they look at government as far back as you can trace as the source of wealth.
Well, government certainly in the what it did was it made it possible for monopolies to exist. I mean, just for instance, the railroads. I mean, they passed laws that not only allowed the railroads to have enough land to lay the railroad down, they handed them a mile on either side where they could build towns that were basically owned by the railroad company, and then they could ship the goods into the town at a profit. And so, you know, they created regulations and rules that favored the corporations and favored the monopolization of wealth.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, clearly that is exactly all the way back from mercantilism.
Yeah,
we've seen exactly the same thing.
I would
argue
all the way back to the deeding of lands in the 11th century and all the way back to the controlled issuance of monies.
Well, I wouldn't disagree with you. I think that there are people who look at government back when it was a monarchy even as the source of wealth, and they see nothing wrong with going after the power of government to make themselves wealthy.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, they would hardly know what to do for a living if they didn't have that. And the people you see going in professionally to the CIA oftentimes come from exactly that background, so it's very natural for them, too.
Yes.
It's really horrifying when you look at it that way, of course.
Well, but I mean, it's not nothing. CIA, DIA is not alien. It's not from some other planet. It's all part of the general structure of the society as a whole. It's just that, you know, when you get to certain levels of concentration of wealth and power and how those are carried out as socially enforced and, you know, as wealth concentrates to a certain point and technological development reaches a certain point, then whole segments of the population are really expendable in that view because you don't need their labor any longer. And that was really the history of the beginning of the Holocaust in Weimar Republic in Germany, of the idea of the useless eater, the person taking up space. And it Holocaust really began in the mental institutions where the psychiatrists developed the crematoria and the gas chambers at killing centers to kill the useless so-called feeble-minded who wouldn't be productive, and they killed about 80% of the mental patients. And mm-hmm. then that technology and expertise was brought to Bergen-Belsen and Auschwitz for the larger Holocaust. But
yeah.
It's an inevitable pressure for genocide if you allow wealth to concentrate and technology to be monopolized.
And that's, of course, horrifying. Now, what happened with... You have all of these conspiracies coming forward, and I said something in my introduction about 9/11, so let's look at that for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
You do you personally have a theory about what happened with 9/11, or at this point, do you just have questions?
Well, I don't have a final conclusion, but I do know, having sat through every meeting of the 9/11 Commission, hearings, and their post transformation into this public dialogue organization, and collected all of their materials. Of course, the report that they gave out is worse than the Warren Commission report, because at least the Warren Commission released some of the evidence. Hale Boggs said, shouldn't we put out some of the evidence, otherwise it'll look a little fishy. Alan Dulles said, well, go ahead and print some of it. He said, nobody will read it anyway. Some of us read it, and I guess they got the message, because the 9/11 Commission report, even though it has over 100 pages in the back and six-point print of references and footnotes to documents, interviews, etc., not all of which by any means are classified, every piece of paper that they relied on in their investigation, all their internal correspondence and everything else, despite our hammering them to release it, was locked up. Three of the nine investigative reports were finally released with disclaimers from the commission members saying, we looked at this, but this isn't an official document. Well, if your investigative team's work isn't part of your consensus, what is? But every document, classified or not, is locked up till January 2nd, 2009.
Was the rationale for locking that up? I mean,
well, they have the power. Any congressional committee or appointed commission has the power to lock it up for a period of up to 50 years or 30 years, you know, depending on how the laws are written. I can't see a rationale if they say that they're trying to get to the truth and look at everything, and why can't we look at it as well? Because if we could go through it, I'm sure it would show that they had pretty flimsy grounds for what they concluded. I'll just give you one example of a pretty primary conclusion that was reached for 9/11, which is about the hijackers, their identity, and their connection to Osama bin Laden. Okay.
Yes.
Seven people came forward in Saudi Arabia and Egypt, according to the BBC and other international news sources, after 9/11, and after the hijackers' names were released so quickly and identified these 19 hijackers, and these people came forward and said, that's me. That's my picture, that's my ID, that's my name. In some cases, they said their ID had been stolen from them, or passports had been stolen from them in the years before. And they said, I wasn't on that plane, I wasn't in the United States. So whoever was on the plane was using their identity, which means that we don't know the real identity of that person. So we can't take that name back 6 months and say that so-and-so was in a Hamburg cell in Germany meeting with so-and-so, because we don't know whether that identity was based on the real person or the person that was on the plane using the fake identity at that time, or in fact a third person using that identity at that time.
Well, it could be anybody then.
That's right. It could be anybody. And so we're starting with the fact that we don't even know the real identities of at least seven of the hijackers. In addition to that,
you have to question all of their identities.
Of course you do. And their identities are critical. And it's also interesting that five of the seven people that came forward and said that work for one company, Saudi Airlines.
Really?
Yes. And so, I mean, in 15 of the identified people, whatever identity they were, but 15 of the used identities were Saudi. But then it's all linked back to Osama bin Laden and the claim that these people had sworn fealty to Osama and were following, you know, the orders of Osama through three people, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, Ramzi bin al-Shib, and Ramzi Youssef. Well, these three people had been, at the time the commission was doing its work, locked up for a period of years in an undisclosed location on indefinite detention. Basically, they were in the rendition program and taken to secret prisons that the CIA was running. The CIA Inspector General's report hinted that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed had at least been waterboarded. There's no reason to think, given the history of all the fighting they did to make torture legal in this war on terror, that the others weren't tortured. And then statements were taken from them, and these statements were used as the basis of saying that these 19 hijackers were in fact part of the plot and were tied to and had gone to Afghanistan and sworn their fealty to Osama bin Laden. That is the only evidence that links these people to bin Laden. And of course, again, you're working with false identities.
So you're saying they don't know anything.
Well, they don't. I mean, you're starting at a very, very basic level of taking the word of the FBI. So the commission staff said, well, can we interview those three people? No. Can we talk to the people who handle them, who are their guards? No. Can we talk to the people who translated this English document that you're handing us to make this proof? The translators, can we talk to them? No. It's basically being put in a position of a prosecutor handing the judge a document saying, a source that we have that we can't reveal or let you talk to says that the defendant is guilty, Your Honor.
Well, that's a fair trial.
I don't know any court where it would stand up for 2 minutes.
If you can't
even question the jailhouse snitch, what use is it going to be? It would be thrown out on its ear. But this is the basis of the evidence. And if you remember, Colin Powell, right after, said that the American people would get a white paper with the evidence that proved the connection to bin Laden in Afghanistan. Then 2 weeks later, he said he had misspoken himself. Then it came out in the paper that they took the evidence instead to the British, who they were involving going into Afghanistan, and in fact were involving going into Afghanistan well before 9/11. And the British press quoted top British officials at 10 Downing Street saying, well, they'd looked at the evidence, and it wasn't enough to go to court, but it was enough to go to war.
Oh, my God.
Now, that's an actual quote. Not enough to go to court, but enough to go to war. That's an interesting standard, isn't it?
Who said that again?
They said they were top British officials at 10 Downing Street.
Seeing
the U.S. white paper of the proof.
And of course,
so it's a pack of cards. And I'm just saying you start from there. You don't have to make up a theory. You start from the fact that the theory you've been given by this commission, which you can't even check by looking at a document. And then I wondered, why did they lock him up till January 2nd, 2009, 4.5 years after the
time?
That election. I said, that's a strange date. I mean, you'd think it'd be 5 years or 10 years, at least an even number. And then I realized that on January 2nd, 2009, Mr. Bush will still be in office.
Oh, so he can do the
reverse the release, and it'll be no political cost to him. People will have forgotten that the 911 Commission set the date and allowed him to do that. And the documents will still be buried. And that's part of the reason I think the first step in investigating and finding out what happened in 9/11 is to push Congress for a 911 Records Act to release at least the forensic evidence and the non-classified documents immediately.
Let's get into this for a second, because this takes us to a place where we have to think about getting off the grids, because there's clearly an informational grid here that
yes.
we're locked into. And the fact is Congress is pretty well owned. There are very few people who are in Congress who they don't, what I call, hold paper on so that they can guarantee what they're going to do on critical votes.
Well, I mean, the way I would put it is that, you know, you don't, you can't afford in this country at this point with this level of power and control to let an election come down to a vote.
Well, and they don't.
They finance the people that they put in office, and they take out the people that stand up to them, Cynthia McKinney being a good case in point.
Yes, okay, but that being the case,
mm-hmm.
we're taking a look at a government that is completely out of control. And realistically, if we can't use...
Well, it's certainly out of control of the popular will.
Well, that's, as far as I'm concerned, that's completely out of control.
But on the other hand, there are, in my experience being in Congress, there are certain wedges that if you use them, and that they can, with a certain level of neutrality to themselves, put them forward... there are elements in Congress who will push forward. Like, for instance, I've been wanting for many years to get loose the files on Martin Luther King. Even when they released the JFK files under the JFK Records Act that I worked on in 6.5 million pages to date, the largest record release in history up until the Nazi Criminal Records Act bypassed it at 8.5 million pages. But this is pages, not records.
Right.
But Freedom of Information Act from 64 to 94, when this commission came in, and the Record Review Board and the JFK Act, maybe 2,000 pages were released. And so we have 6.5 million. So I wanted a similar one because they didn't release the House Select Committee files on King or the other government files. And Cynthia McKinney was in favor of that. I helped her draft a bill. It had 67 co-sponsors in the House. It was picked, a companion bill, identical bill, was picked up in the Senate by John Kerry and then by Hillary. And I think it would have sailed through, but then Coretta died, and some of the King children were balking at releasing the files because they were afraid that it would show something negative about their father.
Well, it probably would have.
Well, it might have, but I mean, my point is to consider the source. I mean, these are paid informants who get their money by saying something bad. But whatever it showed, I mean, if it showed that King was a human being, so what?
Well, I mean, don't disagree with you, but the fact is that it didn't happen.
Well, yes, but I'm just saying it didn't happen more because of the honoring the family than the Congress itself, I think, would have gone in that direction. And I don't think it's impossible to win something in Congress, but I think it has to be something that's framed in a way that, you know, even some of the believers in the Warren Commission supported the JFK Records Act release because they felt that the records would bear them out.
Uh-huh. But we actually also are doing this in a flow of time, and
yes,
our ability to act is changing radically almost on a day-by-day basis.
Yeah.
And so
your ability to act at all is based on what you can know, and Martin Schatz, in his book on the Kennedy assassination, History Will Not Absolve Us, is quoted in a letter to one of the early critics, Vince Solandri. It's a very great quote, and he said the political paralysis in America is based on the fact that we're allowed to believe anything but to know nothing.
Well, and that makes it impossible to make intelligent decisions.
That's
can't
right.
get our feet on the ground.
Jefferson said, given a choice between a government without a newspaper or a newspaper without a government, he would always choose the latter.
And we have no independent media or very little independent media left.
Sorry?
We also have very little independent media left.
Well, we barely have any media, but the media is...
It's entertainment.
Yeah, a lot of it is owned like printing presses, but the electronic media is actually still legally a commonwealth. And it's a commonwealth that we ought to defend and take back from the corporate monopolization of the licensing.
And there are people who have spent tremendous amounts of energy doing exactly that. That's something that, you know, we need to make sure happens.
Mm-hmm.
But what I wanted to point out is that if we want to escape from what seems to be a closing door, we better figure out a strategy.
Absolutely. You're not going to get anywhere without a strategy.
If your strategy is
merely to complain over and over, that isn't going to go anywhere.
Exactly. Absolutely. And what you've done is you've presented, you know, a scenario that shows a narrowing of opportunity, and we know the courts are now absolutely controlled. It's impossible to get much past them, except very occasionally.
Yeah, well, a lot of the existing system is compromised because they've had over 200 years to do so.
Yes, absolutely. So what would you suggest? I mean, I have an expression I use at this point, and I said, press the reboot button.
Press the what?
Press the reboot button.
The reboot button. Yes, would that we could start the game over. But in a sense, that's our responsibility in every generation, is to press that reboot button, to have enough vision to understand what democracy might look like, and to use the tools that we have. Because as bad as the situation is, there's two things that I always keep in mind. One is that they go to all these repressive measures because they're afraid of us.
I know.
And the more repressive they're thinking about it, the more scared they are. It's only us that we don't seem to realize how much power we actually have. And they try to make us believe that we're powerless, but we are not. And the other thing I think, you know, and I often say, another one of my quotes that I'll put up on the website soon is, always remember, there are more of us than we can think.
Amen. I love that quote, by the way, I have to tell you. You know, this has been absolutely fascinating, but I wasn't paying attention to my clock, and we're getting
to
close. But I want to thank you. You have been absolutely fantastic. This is such an insight. What can I say? I've read a lot, and I have learned a lot, and I want to thank you for that. So
thanks for being with
us, and I hope you have a great weekend, and I hope you're willing to come back again and tell us more.
Sure.
Okay, well, you take care and have a wonderful weekend.
All right, you too. Thanks,
Linda. Bye. And that's our show for today, August 10th, 2007. As we do with all our shows, at the end, we read the mission statement of America so that we can know absolutely what we need to do to change our world. This comes from Thomas Jefferson. It's from the Declaration of Independence, and these are your rights. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundations on such principles, and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence, indeed, will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that eventually brings us to freedom. And may God be with you every step of the way. Good night.
Vitaly, the new name in electronic music, presents his new album, Looking at the Stars. Check it out at www.vitalymusic.com and here at BBS Radio, your first choice for unconventional and original music.